This is audiobook of, found online as text, They Live in the Sky, by Trevor James Constable. Pertinent excerpts from a flying saucer classic of the 1950s. It is unlikely that the truth about flying saucers will reach the public through governmental agencies. The reason for this is not to be found in any malicious desire to conceal the truth, but simply in the fact that neither the governments nor any individuals know the truth about UFO. Early in my own UFO studies, I concluded that officialdom throughout the world hopelessly at sea over the whole UFO phenomenon, and that its evidential aspects were so completely beyond conventional science that an ordinary man like myself might have as good a chance of penetrating the mystery as anyone else. Flying Saucers, The UFO, by observation both electronic and visual, are fait accompli, and arguments as to whether they exist or not are idle, time-wasting and an obstacle to further investigation. In this book we presume that the UFO are real and get down to the discussion of the queries: where do they come from? What are they? And what do they want? And the less actively pursued question: what is the nature of their reality? The point of departure for me with standard UFO writings came over the question of communication and these UFO and contact with the occupants of the craft, if indeed they were craft at all. The reason I believed that communication must be possible with the craft was that in rather extensive travels around the world I had noted that civilization in every country was directly proportional to communications development. The reason I had paid attention to communications development was that I was at the time of my journeyings a radio officer in the British Merchant Navy. In parts of the Orient and Middle East, a telephone is still a very rare instrument. If you can find one at all, a call to a point 100 miles away may take a day or two, or you might never get it. Telegraph communications are scanty, and radio almost non-existent. One reaches bottom where communication is concerned in those portions of Africa where the tree trunk drum or the human runner still serve as the means. In these locales, material civilization is at its most retarded. This fact of communications as the index of civilization is not widely appreciated in the United States, where through habit, we speak, write, and project the human image over thousands of miles with a familiarity bound to breed contempt for it. Far from being happy with our communications, including radio and television in their exquisite refinements, manufacturers are driven to improve and expand their services by relentless competitive pressure for improved ability to communicate. The ability to communicate on a worldwide scale in a variety of media is available to every American, and in this country we have the highest material civilization known on this planet. The technical superiority of the aliens, it is obvious from their observed speeds and maneuvers, their advanced propulsion systems as now acknowledged, their ability to appear and disappear, that the UFO are undeniably products of a civilization immeasurably advanced beyond our own, technologically speaking. While we boast in our newspapers of airplanes capable of 1,500 miles per hour, other craft, perhaps not of this world, have been electronically measured traveling 6 times this speed, and more, in our atmosphere. In my view, it is irrational to admit the existence of such advanced vehicles and then deny to their occupants the ability to communicate on a scale far beyond anything we now have. If communication is the handmaiden of technological progress, as is the case in our own earthly civilization, it is logical to assume that it will be true of other worlds and civilizations. They may look upon our radio as humorously primitive, and regard our best radar and electronic detection apparatus as infantile. We must also not forget that they may have developed natural communication methods to a high degree, since all that we have in the way of communications is nothing more than the externalization of the contents of our minds. The radio transmitter was conceived in the mind of man, then externalized, that is, fabricated. In a sense, the radio transmitter is nothing more than materialized thought. My own viewpoint at the time I began my investigations was that the probability was very great that these UFO beings would have communication methods as far beyond ours as those of modern America are beyond the tree trunk drum. I have found nothing subsequently to nullify this viewpoint, and overwhelming evidence that it is true. In the light of the above reasoning, I found it absurd that so many otherwise able and intelligent men writing on the UFO could be so adamant in saying that there had been no communication with saucer beings. On the one hand, as ufologists and saucer proselytizers, they recognize the presence in the atmosphere of the products of an advanced civilization, while on the other they virtually deny the controlling intelligences any ability in communication. The most unfortunate part of this viewpoint is that it was and is held today without investigation. Investigation reveals the theory to be false. For myself, I sought to become as a little child. By sweeping out of my mind accumulations of dogma and prejudice, I began by placing myself in the position of UFO beings and wondered what my course of action would be if I wanted to contact humans on the surface of the Earth. No room at the INN. Could I, for example, go straight to the President of the United States? I felt that this would not be feasible. For the moment, the President met with his advisors and told them a space being had communicated with him. The conclusion would doubtless be drawn that the pressure of the job had unhinged his mind. The same applies to all top government officials. Science, in the orthodox sense, would also have to be counted out quickly. All that dogma, all those misconceptions, all those brilliant minds banged, barred and bolted against anything radical. The UFO being might reason that this type of mind, which has been the major obstacle to innovation since the time of Galileo, is the poorest possible soil for new cosmic ideas. It seems to me that the UFO beings would finally be compelled to start at the bottom and work up, rather than at the top and work down, slowly letting their presence, purposes and ability to communicate seep through the general population, forcing governments to take cognizance of the claims. In this way, I came to visit Giant Rock, California, a desert airstrip in an isolated spot with a long history as a landing ground for aliens in pre-war days and as a burial ground for Indians in pre-paleface days. A 70-foot-high boulder with enormous girth? In this arid, flinty locale there dwells a man who seems to harmonize with his environment. Middle-aged, with sandy, thinning hair, George Van Tassel is one of the pioneers of communication with the UFO. Communication? No radio towers or antennae or electronic equipment clutter the area, for communication is carried on by telepathy, or thought transference. This skill, known to and used by the ancients and basically possessed by every human being, is one of the God-given faculties. It has atrophied in most of us through centuries of non-use. Beneath the rock a large chamber has been hewn from the ground and furnished with chairs and tables. From this room, Mr. Van Tassel carries out his communications with the saucer beings. In complete darkness and after preparatory measures closely resembling those of a seance room, the booms forth from Van Tassel's direction a voice that is most definitely not his own. I am Hulder, your people will soon witness more fireballs, which we are dropping as nullifiers of atomic fallout. Greetings of love and peace to you. More messages follow, in voices which vary in accent, in timbre, in a manner that would be beyond the ability of even the most talented actor. These discourses deal with a variety of subjects, including life on other planets, UFO propulsion and always with atomic power. 20. The telltale change of personality. In my view, the entities speaking through Mr. Van Tassel were of a standard of intelligence far beyond his own, with grammar, sentence construction, and vocabulary beyond Mr. Van Tassel's attainments. The use of his personal physical facilities for these beings to manifest indicates that they are able to manifest here on Earth only through the agency of suitable humans, although this is not yet entirely proven. Mr. Van Tassel is willing enough to give an earnest seeker the method of preparing oneself for this type of contact. He told me when I asked him and made no claims for patent rights or special talent. He did warn of possible ill effects but fired with enthusiasm I paid his cautioning little heed. In the light of my own later experiences with telepathy, I do not consider it wise to dispense the information regarding preparation for it to all and sundry. It can be dangerous and there are those who will dabble in these things who are totally unprepared for such activity. I know because I was just that type of person myself. Having asked for what I got, I have no complaints, but I will not myself be responsible for dispensing the same information to others, and hence it is excluded from this text. In the months that followed, I sought contact consistently. As an investigator, I felt this was the only fair way to test the suggestions Mr. Van Tassel had given me. Until I had, I was in no position to pass judgment on this contact business. Like all applications of spiritual science, investigation inevitably involves participation. One cannot afford the luxury of the onlooker consciousness, nor stand the penalties its misconceptions inflict upon spiritual growth. One participates, one experiences, and then one knows. The truth is within the one who has had the experience, and it may not be contradicted or negated, not by high-domed pontiff, by atheistic scientist, nor by military officers active or retired. There is only one way to test the validity of UFO communication, and that is to try it. He who has not tried it is not qualified to render judgments on its possibilities or probabilities. The months slipped past without results of any kind. However, I resolved that I would persist for a minimum period of 6 months, discouraged or not. Any other attitude would have been unfair and inconclusive. I continued to study the UFO, of course, seeking to find the central theme of coherence that would make the pieces fit. One night at about 10 o'clock I was reading Kehoe's Flying Saucer Conspiracy with some care to particular details of one chapter. Suddenly I was seized by an overpowering impulse, which I now realize was a tremendous thought impression, to pick up a pen and write. Obeying this impulse, I picked up a pencil and began writing on the cover of a paperback book, the only thing handy on which I could make a mark. My arm was impelled and controlled by an unseen force, and I wrote a largely unintelligible scrawl. Part 2. One night at about 10 o'clock I was reading Kehoe's Flying Saucer Conspiracy with some care to details of one particular chapter. Suddenly, I was seized by an overpowering impulse, which I now realize was a tremendous thought impression, to pick up a pen and write. Obeying the impulse, I picked up a pencil and began writing on the cover of a paperback book, the only thing handy on which I could make a mark. My arm was impelled and controlled by an unseen force, and I wrote a scrawl which was largely unintelligible across the back of the book. At the bottom of the cover I distinctly wrote the word discontinue, at which time the force on my arm was released just as though a switch had been thrown. I discussed this happening with my wife, who was somewhat startled. I stood in the middle of the floor gesticulating and was giving vent to my amazement, when a similar force was exerted upon my head, drawing it upwards and backwards with surprising power. By a great effort of will I was able to return my head to the normal position. The moment I ceased twirling it, that the force drew it upwards and backwards once more. Suddenly, as before, the force cut off as though switched, and my puzzlement was now doubled. I discussed it briefly with my wife, and a few minutes later had an overwhelming desire to go outside. Not wishing to further alarm my wife, I made the excuse that I had to go outside and move the car. As I moved to the door, my right hand rose to the knob by this self-same force and closed around it. Once again, I could will it to my side. I turned my body slightly so that the left hand was nearer to the knob, and it too rose and grasped the knob without any conscious effort on my part. I went outside and descended the stairs. Immediately upon reaching the bottom of the stairs, the force seized upon my whole body and I was propelled like a mechanical man down the street, halting at the corner. My body was spun around in a neat military right turn and I walked to the end of the block. Here again I was stopped, spun in yet another right turn and propelled in the same manner right around the block. Returning to the entrance to my apartment, the force once again was removed as though it had been switched off. Inside, I thought deeply about this entire process, not knowing what to conclude, since no communication of any kind had reached me, 11, other than the unintelligible scrawl on the book cover. All I could think was that this had been some kind of a test. Today, of course, I look upon it as nothing more or less than an attempt to gain complete control of me, with disaster averted only by my absolutely inflexible resolve to remain master in my own house. Conscious mediumship, the best kind. After a while I went to bed. Hardly in bed 5 minutes, I suddenly found my entire vocal mechanism functioning involuntarily, and through it, intelligent words and phrases were being conveyed to me. I did not hear voices, either at this time or at any other subsequent time, but rather listened to my own speech mechanism, which was being used as the agency to communicate with me. The message, as best I can recall, went something like this: "I am Ashtar. I greet you from Shkare, Shari. Your interest in our cause is well known and we would like you to help us. Would you be willing to do so?" The message then conveyed some intelligence to me concerning a theory of mine on the UFO, which proved my theory both incorrect and potentially dangerous to me. I therefore felt that this initial communication, containing such a warning with intimate knowledge of the subject concerned, was indeed genuine. However, I was still greatly disturbed by the entire happening, even though I had sought to make contact with more than a little devotion. I had the inner feeling that all might not be what it seemed. Because of this, I sought out a kind gentleman greatly learned in occult matters and related my experience to him. From this man I obtained certain secret information concerning the protection of oneself during telepathic contact, since all who seek to contact one by telepathy may not be spacemen. This, my first contact with the world outside the purely physical, was a jolt to me. Reared in Christian Science, I was not prepared for any of these things, and least of all for the concept of aggressive forces in the unseen worlds. These few vital minutes with this remarkable man were probably the most important of my life. Without the advice I received and the knowledge to which I was made party in my own need, I would no doubt have been in serious danger. At this point, as I see it now, although I could not see it then, I was about half ready. In the weeks and months that followed, I was able to appreciate that all beings, or intelligences, who circle our globe, or dwell near it, in high-performance craft are not tall, handsome spacemen, free of dental caries and possessed of long, golden hair. Nor are all these intelligences governed by a desire to uplift humanity. There are benign beings. And there are others, whose morals, ethics, purposes and allegiances are the antithesis of all that a Christian man holds dear. There are still others, not human, who are probably not even conscious of our presence. To be continued with Ashtar's communications to Trevor James in 1957. Part 3. The information that follows, and the comment on it by myself, is presented with the sole purpose of attempting to clarify the murkiest aspect of the UFO mystery for all who earnestly seek the answers. With the earnest seeking, it is almost mandatory for the truly sincere person to be intellectually bold enough to realize that the superphysical is very real. The messages are authentic communications through a form of telepathy, by myself, with an unseen intelligence or intelligences. In every case I was fully conscious, and at no time was I under any form of control, seen or unseen. I had the power to instantly terminate any contact at any time, and the power to interrogate the invisible communicator in the course of the communication. To the best of my knowledge, I have no telepathic power whatever with other human beings, and it is my present view that this system of communication used by these intelligences is simply tuned to the personal frequency of the human being and the intelligence passed in this way. No person should conclude that any special ability is required. Immediately upon terminating each contact, the messages were compiled into written form as close to verbatim as possible. Later communications were taped, but none of these are now available, and any tapes offered for sale using my name in this connection are bogus. Trevor, are you etheric beings or are you possessed of a fleshly physical body such as mine? Ashtar, I am etheric. I do not have a fleshly body like yours, bounded by flesh. But it is possible for me to make my being visible to your optics by certain changes in the vibratory rate. Trevor, this would mean that you are normally invisible to us? Ashtar, yes. Trevor, as you are an etheric being, are other etheric beings visible to you? Ashtar, yes, although not exactly in terms of optical vision as you know it. 10. It was about 18 months after this communication had been received that I gained a rather startling proof of its validity. realizing early in the game that an understanding of at least the rudiments of occultism and other aspects of philosophy were vital, I had pursued various phases of these subjects in the role of an investigator. I paid a call on a distinguished European lady in Los Angeles with an international reputation as a seer and psychic. Discussing various aspects of her faculty with me and answering my questions, she suddenly sat bolt upright in her chair. "Have you ever had any contact with any non-physical beings?" she asked with a smile. I replied that I believed I had, but not be completely sure. She then said, "There is a magnificent looking being standing beside you, and he communicates to me that his name is Ashtar. Do you know him?" I replied that the personality was familiar, and she gave me a full description of him as she saw him clairvoyantly. 7 feet tall, extremely stern, helmeted and giving the impression of being a sort of military man. Guardian commander of cislunar space. This was extremely interesting insofar as Ashtar had described himself as the commandant, Vela Quadrisector, realms of Shkare, all projections, all waves, and therefore would probably be a military type of being. Since I had not told her anything of my own activities in the UFO field, and she had never previously met me, I considered this incident to be a somewhat remarkable indication that Ashtar, in describing himself, had in fact told the truth, insofar as we could establish that truth. I saw nothing myself, being possessed of only ordinary sight. Trevor, from your statement that you are etheric, am I to presume that you have evolved beyond the stage of a physical and astral body? Ashtar, correct. I do not possess a physical casing of the dense type such as yours. I am definitely etheric, as are all people on other planets in this solar system. The Rosicrucian chart on page 1 of the Jan-February journal illustrates this. However, this does not mean that we are invisible to each other as we are to you under normal circumstances. We see each other and live much as you do, but we do not have this dense physical casing which you possess. The advantages, benefits and comforts of this living are enormous, and the irritations of the fleshly envelope are most uncomfortable. Unless we choose to convert the vibrational frequencies of our bodies to one which is visible to your optics, we remain invisible to your people. Highly evolved people, with a good psychic eye as you call it, can sometimes see us in vaporous form, although we may be invisible to other earthlings in the same location. When your clairvoyants travel to our civilizations on other planets, they see and are able to interpret our lives because they are not using their physical eyes but their astral or psychic sight, to which we are visible just as though we were physical. Trevor, when you become visible to our eyes, does the person who sees you know that you are a converted etheric? Ashtar, not as a rule. The conversion can be made so completely that a physical person encountering us thinks that we, too, are physical. Working within human limitations. Trevor, what of those who claim to have been up in your craft? Ashtar, in our contacts with earthlings we have to be careful not to go beyond their understanding. In these instances, the ships and all entities within them are converted to a vibrational level at which they had the substance of physical things as known to you. Whether the experience was physical or astral is not known to some people who had the experience. Trevor, the astral and etheric concepts are difficult to grasp at first. Ashtar, persistent of faith. There is much to learn. Trevor, I wish to ask a question or two concerning etheric substance. Ashtar, we will be glad to answer whatever we can for you. We wish to arm you with as much knowledge as possible, and are limited in this only by your power to assimilate it. I do not wish to talk over your head, but we will supply you with knowledge to the limit of your understanding. Trevor, I am puzzled by the concept of etheric matter. For example, there is one case on record where one of our jet aircraft flew right through a spaceship without hitting anything solid whatever. Are your ships made of a vaporous substance or are they a different form of earthly matter? Ashtar, we have all the elements you know on Earth and many more. The etheric form of these metals differs in its atomic and molecular structure from Earth-made metals. For example, The distance between the nucleus and the orbiting electrons of the etheric ion nucleus is much greater than in iron as you know it on Earth. This permits the atoms of earthly steel to pass right through the atoms of etheric steel in such a way nothing happens to either form of steel. The etheric form of steel enjoys a higher vibratory rate than earthly steel and therefore is not apparent to earthly vision, or if you prefer, physical eyesight. Under certain circumstances it becomes visible, as in the presence of certain atmospheric gases of Shan, Earth, or at will in accordance with the desire of the controlling intelligence. No matter how great the mass of the etheric substance, even a spaceship measuring many miles across in your measure, physical matter cannot damage or injure it or its contents. Trevor, when you speak of making etheric matter visible at will, is this the way that George Adamski was permitted to take his now famous photographs? Asked R, yes. Ether ships, as they have been called on your surface, have been made visible to and for certain individuals, selected, upon your surface of whom Adamski is one. Normally, the ships are part of the invisible world. Trevor, if one were to develop astral vision, or the psychic eye, would he be able to see the ships? Asked R, no. Not unless the vibratory rate of the ship were converted to the vibratory range of astral vision. Remember, the etheric vibratory rate is higher than the astral. Very few physical humans have some perception of the etheric, but they are not normal people as you know them and for the most part dwell in very secluded places. As a general rule, perception of the etheric through vision cannot be accomplished except through the will of the etheric, converting etheric substance to a vibratory level where it is physically visible. Cleaning up the nuclear fallout. Trevor, is the puzzling phenomenon of the fireballs dropped from your craft? Asked R, yes. Trevor, what is their purpose? Asked R, the fireballs are nullifiers for certain radioactive effects which your scientists do not even know they are releasing. These nullifiers prevent the poisoning of your people, and are released upon the orders of our Heavenly Father. We cannot intervene actively in the cessation of such experiments, but we must do all possible to prevent the wanton destruction of human life resulting from these experiments. Trevor, it has been noted that the air contains a large percentage of copper after these fireballs have been seen. Asked R, this is true. It is part of the fireball's function. For the most part, these fireballs are seen in the vicinity of atomic installations and laboratories. But not all fireballs are ours, and all do not have the same purpose. The implication of this message is clear, more than one faction must be at work, for not all fireballs are ours. Soon I was to learn the truth of this, and in learning this truth, to gain information which unraveled many of the unsolved mysteries of the UFO. To be continued in the next journal, with excerpts from Chapter 3, Foes. Part 4. And he laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil, and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years, and cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up, and set a seal upon him, that he should deceive the nations no more, till 1,000 years should be fulfilled and after that, he must be loosed a little season. Revelations 20-2-3. At about the same time I received the information concerning the fireballs, especially that portion which stated that all did not come from the same craft, I came into contact with the now famous Shaven mystery, and his claim that entities identifying themselves as the Duro are an underground race living today within our planet. Trevor, a question that has greatly disturbed me, concerns the presence of an underground race on this planet. I would appreciate any information you can give me. Asked R. At the core of your planet there dwells a greatly degenerated race, an astral race, which is degenerate not so much in science, but in every moral respect as you know and understand it. They are capable of spaceflight within the astral regions around the Earth, but are earthbound. They are the forces of Uranus, whom you call Satan. They emerge at the South Pole. On your surface they have allies who are without morals and without mercy. I give you this information that you may be aware of their existence. I enjoin you to forever close any researches into this astral activity, in the interests of your own welfare. Be on your guard, Always be careful and vigilant. Trevor, these astrals from the Earth's core are, I take it, the Dero of legend? Asht, no.